And we've got to see dads baptize their kids, life group leaders baptize kids who are in their small group here at church, people from out of town who've gotten connected with their church family. As we talked about a couple of weeks ago, man, the harvest is plentiful right now. The harvest is ripe, and God has been using our church to reach people for Jesus, and it's a blessing and a privilege to be a part of. If you have your Bible with you, go ahead and find your way to Song of Songs, chapter 1. You'll find this towards the middle of your Bible, right after the book of Ecclesiastes. And we are in week 2 of our teaching series called Love Songs, where we're walking through the Song of Songs together and looking at what the Bible has to say about love, sex, and marriage. And if you missed last week, let me give you just a quick recap to kind of get you up to speed. The Song of Songs is a book of Hebrew poetry written by King Solomon. And it describes the relationship between him and this Shulamite woman. And in the book, we see this couple go from initial interest and attraction into a season of engagement. We see them get married and go on a honeymoon. We see them have their first fight and conflict as a married couple. We see them grow old together. And the book is sort of like a musical. Mark, I know you're a big fan of musicals. Sort of like a musical where the husband and wife are singing back and forth to one another, and they're using poetic language to describe different aspects of their relationship. And last week, we talked about the importance of becoming and finding the right kind of person. How do we become the right kind of person? And how do we find the right kind of person? And our big idea last week is that character is the foundation of a godly relationship. While physical attraction and physical appearance are certainly matter and are certainly important, character must be the foundation for a godly relationship. Because while physical beauty eventually fades, character is what lasts. Character is what remains. And so we need to prioritize and pursue the things that the Lord values most. The Bible tells us that man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. He looks at our character. He looks at our integrity. And so today in week 2 of our series, we're going to talk about pursuing someone in a way that honors the Lord. And in our modern culture today, the way that we typically do that, the way that we pursue someone is through dating, where we meet somebody in person, or these days more likely meeting somebody online. We spend some time getting to know them and talking with them. We go on a first date together. We take them to, you know, to Arby's and get them some curly fries and the Jamocha shake. We seal the deal with the Arby's dinner, and then they become our boyfriend, our girlfriend. We date for a while. Eventually, you know, you get engaged, you plan a wedding, and then you get married. But what we have to realize is that dating is a fairly modern concept. Like, it's really only existed for about the last 150 years. And it's still primarily a Western concept. There are still cultures in our world today that don't practice dating the way that we think about it. And so because this is a modern Western practice, the Bible doesn't say anything specifically about how to date, because dating didn't exist during biblical times. In those days, people would typically find their spouse through arranged marriages, where the parents, particularly the dad, would select the spouse for their children. And they were primarily concerned with family legacy, with economic stability. They didn't really care about romance and love and passion, which is what makes the Song of Songs so unique. Because in a time where most people were being set up by their parents, here is this couple who is passionately and voluntarily pursuing one another. Now, they're not necessarily, you know, dating the way that we would think about it today, but they are intentionally pursuing one another and are building this romantic relationship together. And so even though the Bible doesn't give us a list of how-tos when it comes to dating, you're not going to find rules in the Bible of how to date or how old you should be or how long you should date for, there are still biblical principles that we can take and apply to the modern practice of dating, especially from the book of Song of Songs. And so today, what we're going to do is we're going to walk through this passage together. We're going to see this couple pursuing one another. And then just like last week, I want to spend the kind of the first half of the message talking to those who are not yet married. Maybe you're dating somebody right now, or you're going to be dating somebody in the future. And then the second half of the message is dedicated to those of you who are parents, who have kids who are dating right now, or who have kids who are going to be dating in the future. And so today, we're going to pick up where we left off last week in chapter 1, verse 7. And here the woman is speaking, and she says this. She says, "Tell me, you whom I love, where you graze your flock and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends?" So what's going on here? What is she saying? This woman wants to know where her man is going to be. She says, "Tell me where you graze your flock and where you rest your sheep. Tell me where you're going to be hanging out, because I want to spend time together. I value our relationship. I want to see you. I want to be around you." There's no text messaging. There's no Instagram here. The only way she's going to see him is by being in his presence. And look at how he responds to her. He says, "If you do not know, most beautiful of women, follow the tracks of the sheep and graze your young goats by the tents of the shepherds." Notice he's not ignoring her. He's not blowing her off. He's not putting her in the friend zone. No, he's reciprocating this desire to be with her. He's saying, "Hey, I want to see you too. I want to spend time with you." And he's being very clear and upfront about his intentions and his desires. He says, "This is where I'm going to be. This is when I'm going to be there. I want you to come and visit. I want to see you. I want to spend time together." And listen to what he says to her next in verse 9. He says, "I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot horses. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels." Now, I would not suggest referring to your girlfriend or your wife as a horse. It probably won't be received well. But here, what he is doing is he is praising her and affirming her. He's saying, "You stand out above the rest. You are unique. You are distinct. And I'm drawn to you. I'm attracted to you in a way that I'm not drawn to other women." He's building her up. He's encouraging her with the words that he's speaking to her. You know, if you remember from last week, this woman felt insecure about the way that she looked. She told him, don't look at me because my skin has been darkened by the sun." She had been out working in the vineyards, doing manual labor, and was embarrassed about the way that she looked. But he's telling her, "Hey, I see those things that you may feel insecure about. I see those things that you're embarrassed about, but I think you're perfect. And you don't need to change anything about yourself in order to have my love or my affection. I'm drawn to you exactly as you are." And then listen to what their friends who are watching this relationship grow, how they chime in and respond in verse 11. They say, "We will make you earrings of gold studded with silver." You know, I don't know about you, but I've had friends who started dating somebody, and almost immediately I knew that it was going to be a disaster. Like, you could look at it and be like, "No, from my way, this is not going to end well." But that friend, they were so infatuated with this person, they were so attracted to them that they were ignoring all of the red flags that were starting to pop up. They wouldn't listen to the advice of friends. They wouldn't listen to the wisdom of mentors. But here, the friends of this couple, they want to bless this woman with a gift. Why? Because they're excited and hopeful for this relationship. They feel good about how things are growing, about how things are progressing. They don't see any red flags. They don't see any issues or concerns. Instead, they're cheering them on and they're supporting them. They're like, "Hey, you're a great guy. You're a great girl. This relationship seems healthy and life-giving. We want to support you. We want to encourage you." And then for the rest of chapter 1, Solomon and this woman, they go back and forth with one another, praising each other, encouraging each other, affirming one another. But then look at what she says at the start of chapter 2 and verse 1. She says, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. And what I want you to notice is how much her view of herself has changed since chapter one. Rather than feeling self-conscious and insecure about the way that she looks, their time together has made her more secure and more confident in who God has created her to be. Because her man has been affirming her and encouraging her and building her up. He's been working to remove the insecurities that she had. And what an important reminder for us today, that the person you are pursuing, they should make you feel more confident and more secure in who God has created you to be. You should not be dating somebody. You should not be pursuing a relationship with somebody who makes you feel inferior or less than or insecure. Someone who's constantly trying to change you and nitpick you and point out your flaws and what's wrong with you. No, a healthy relationship, what we see here, it should be life-giving. It should build you up. It should make you more confident and more secure in who you are. And listen to what he says back to her in verse 2. He says, like a lily among thorns is my darling among the young women. He says, you are a flower among the thorns, meaning out of all the women out there, out of all the women I could be interested in, you are the one that I'm pursuing. You are the one that I'm focused on. I'm not trying to keep my options open. I'm not talking to multiple people at once. I'm not trying to keep a backup plan in case things don't work. No, I have a distinct interest in you. I'm committed to you. I see this going somewhere. I'm pursuing you. I'm being intentional. And she responds back in verse 3 by saying this, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my beloved among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. She compares this man that she's in a relationship with to a healthy, life-giving tree because she has found a sense of peace and security in this relationship. If you remember from last week, she was in a situation where she was vulnerable and being taken advantage of and worn down, but she has now found rest and peace in this relationship. This relationship is bringing out the best of who she is. It's making her more confident, more secure, more at peace, more at rest. And so this morning, if you are not yet married, and you hope to be married in the future, maybe you're dating now, maybe you'll be dating in the future, I want to give you three very quick principles for dating. And there are a lot of things that I wish we had time to cover today. By about Wednesday of this week, I realized there was probably going to be enough content for like 2 weeks worth of messages here, but I've kind of boiled it down to three things. I think that if you can get these principles right, that it will solve 90% of the potential issues that may pop up in dating. That doesn't mean these things are easy, but if you can get these right, these solve a lot of problems. And the first one I think is probably the most important. Don't date for potential. Listen, dating is not the NFL draft. You're not dating somebody for who you hope they might become in the future if circumstances and the environment are favorable. No, we date someone for who they actually are today, their character, their values, their integrity, their faith. You know, a lot of Christians will practice what we call in church world missionary dating, where they'll date somebody who's not a Christian in hopes that they will become a Christian. They hope that by spending time with them and inviting them to church and being around them, that they'll kind of wear off on them and eventually win them over. And listen, I've seen this happen before. I've seen God work in that way between a couple where one's a believer and one's not, and God uses that relationship to bring them to the Lord. It's certainly not impossible. But more often than not, it's the Christian in the relationship who ends up compromising their values and their convictions, not the other way around. Listen, if you are a follower of Jesus and you are considering dating somebody. The bar, the standard for what you're aiming for should not just be, oh, they're nice. Or, you know, they go to church every once in a while. Or, you know, they're supportive of my beliefs. They're supportive of my faith. No, the bar should be, do they love and follow Jesus? Not, are they going to maybe be interested in Jesus in the future? No, are they following him today? Are they living out their faith right now? Is there the fruit of the Spirit in their life? Like, that's the bar. That's the standard. And this should be a non-negotiable when it comes to dating as a believer. Listen to what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, talking about marriage. He says, don't be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what fellowship do righteousness and iniquity have? Or what fellowship does light have with darkness? Listen, as a pastor, I've done a lot of premarital counseling. And I've sat down with couples, months before they got married, and it was very obvious that they were not on the same page when it came to their faith. One was a Christian, and the other wasn't. Or one took their faith really seriously, and the other was just kind of more indifferent about it. And almost every time, the one who took their faith more seriously, typically the girl in the relationship, would convince herself that once they got married, it would change. Once they got married, he would get on board. Once they got married, he would start to take things seriously. But listen, if they aren't taking their faith seriously now, why would they start taking it seriously when you get married? And what happens is, I've seen it over and over, is that the one who is strong in their faith, they will either end up making compromises in their faith, in their convictions, to keep peace in the relationship, or it will become a point of tension and frustration in their marriage, especially once they start having kids of their own and start thinking about, how are we going to raise them? What values are we going to be involved in church? That's why we don't date for potential, for who we hope that they will become. We date for who they are today. Do they love and follow Jesus? Is there fruit in their life? Are they pursuing the Lord? The second principle is this, is don't expect someone to complete you. Listen, you're setting yourself up for disappointment and really setting your relationship up for failure if you think you're going to find this perfect person who is going to complete you, who's going to fix every issue in your life. Sometimes I think we have these unrealistic expectations of the people that we date, where we have all of these boxes that we're expecting them to meet, and we put this unrealistic pressure and expectation on them. Listen, no one is going to be perfect. And no one is going to check all the boxes. No one is going to be able to complete you, because anybody that you find is going to be just as broken and fallen as you are. The only one in your life who can meet the deepest desires and longings of your heart, the only one who can fill the void in your heart, is Jesus. And if you try to put that weight on a person or on a relationship, you will crush that relationship and that person under that weight. They will disappoint you, and you will suffocate the relationship in the process. They're not meant to carry that weight for you, and you're not meant to carry that weight for them. Only through Jesus can those things be satisfied. And so when you're thinking about dating, you're asking, hey, are they following Jesus? Do they have good character? Do they treat me well? And then all these other things you can figure out. You're not looking for someone who's perfect. You don't have to align on all of your hobbies and your personality and your preferences. Make the main things the main things. Do they love the Lord? Do they have integrity? Do they treat you well? Don't expect to find this perfect person who's going to complete you. And then number three, lean on wise counsel as you date. Listen, love makes you blind, and hormones make you stupid. It's truth. And when you are falling in love with somebody and you are infatuated with somebody, you will overlook a lot of glaring red flags. And so you need to have people in your life who speak truth to you. Christian friends, mentors, parents, people whose opinion that you trust. And if the majority of them are starting to point out things in your relationship or the person that you're dating, concerns they have, red flags they see popping up, you would be foolish to ignore them. Because when you're dating, you start to develop blind spots and don't always see the bigger picture. Proverbs chapter 12 says this, that the way of fools seems right to them, but the wise listen to advice. Fools are driven by their emotion and their feelings, but the wise step back and they lean on wise counsel. They listen to the advice and the guidance of trusted friends and mentors. Listen, the way that you date matters, even when you're in high school, even when you're in college, because you are developing relational habits and relational patterns that you are going to take with you into the future. And so you want to pursue someone in a way that honors the Lord. And I wish I could spend a whole lot more time camping out here. But if you have more thoughts, more questions about dating, our 1825 director, Zach Murphy, said he'd be happy to field any questions you may have. He'll grab lunch with you. He'll talk with you. If you need his phone number after service, come and find me, and I'll point you in the right direction. But for the rest of our time this morning, I want to talk specifically to parents. And I've heard a lot of messages on dating in terms of people who are single and trying to date. I've heard very few messages on helping parents think about dating for their children. Some of you in here, you have college-age kids who are in a serious relationship or who are in the process of getting engaged or getting married. Some of you have middle school or high school-age kids who are trying to figure this dating thing out for the very first time. Some of you have young kids like I do, and you feel like you are years away from having to think about this or worry about it. It's not even on your radar yet. But wherever you are in your parenting journey, here's what I want to encourage you with this morning. You need to have a game plan for how your family is going to approach dating. You need to have a plan. And I'm not here to tell you what that plan needs to be. I'm not here to tell you what rules you need to have for your kids, but you need to have a plan. And you need to be intentional, because dating is a discipleship opportunity for you with your kids. You know, I think most Christian parents tend to lean in one of two directions when it comes to their kids dating. The first approach is kind of the overprotective, over-controlling approach, where we keep our kids in a bubble and we try to micromanage every aspect of their life. And it's typically from good intentions. We want to keep them safe. We want to protect them. We don't want them to be exposed to the things of the world. But the problem with this approach, when it's taken to its extreme, is that their kids eventually leave home, and when they do, they're completely unprepared for the real world. And oftentimes what you see is those kids who grow up in a bubble and are overprotected, they quickly go off the rails because they don't know how to think about or handle these different realities of life. But the other approach that many Christian parents take is to be completely hands-off when it comes to their kids' dating life. They'll say things like, you know, I'm just gonna let them figure it out on their own. I'm just going to let them learn from their mistakes. I don't want to overstep. I don't want to be overbearing. I'm just going to kind of let them figure it out. But in what other area of parenting would we take that approach? Like, you would never hand your kids the keys to the car and say, hey, go teach yourself how to drive. Hey, good luck. Hey, I'm sure you'll figure it out. I'm sure you're going to learn from your mistakes. No, you're going to coach them and guide them and instruct them. And then you slowly loosen the reins over time as they become more mature and more responsible. Listen, here is the problem with the hands-off approach. your kids, when they are teenagers especially, are not mentally or emotionally prepared to just figure it out by themselves. And if you make the decision that you are going to neglect your responsibility of teaching and instructing, they are going to look to someone else to teach them. They're going to look to their friends, to social media, to some show on Netflix. Like, they're going to take their cues from someone, but it is your job and responsibility as their parent to lean in, to engage, and to help them figure it out. And so the question is, like, if it's this important, then why don't more Christian parents engage in this part of their kids' lives? I think for some parents, if they were being honest, it's that they don't care. They're not concerned about it. It's not important to them. They're just going to let their kids figure it out. But I'm going to give everybody in this room the benefit of the doubt, and I'm going to assume that you do care and that you do think it's important. And I think the more common reason is that parents just, they don't know what to do. And they don't know how to help, and they don't know what to say, and they feel very awkward and very uncomfortable talking to their kids about these kinds of things. You know, I've met dads who run multi-million dollar businesses or who are high-level executives in their company. And they will hire people and fire people. They will have tough conversations at work all day long. Like, they make hard decisions. But when it comes to talking to their own kids about sex and about dating, they're terrified because it's completely out of their comfort zone. And rather than leaning in to the awkwardness and embracing it, they opt out and say, hey, I'll let your mom handle that, or I'll let you figure it out on your own, or you can talk to your older sibling about that. Listen, talking to your kids about this kind of stuff is going to be awkward. And your kids are going to do everything they can to avoid having these conversations with you. If they're in the room with you right now, they're getting real nervous that you guys are going to be having some conversation later tonight. They're not happy with me right now. And so you have to help your kids think biblically about these things because you're the parent. It's your job. It's your responsibility. And you need to lean in and engage even when you don't feel like it. Paul says this in Ephesians chapter 6. He says, fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Deuteronomy 6, these commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. We need to bring up our kids in the training and instruction of the Lord. We need to impress these things on our kids. And so when it comes to dating, as Christian parents, we need to find this healthy middle ground where we're not overprotective and over-controlling and putting them in a bubble, but where we are being intentional, engaging, and we have some kind of plan. The plan's going to adapt, it's going to adjust, it's going to be different for every kid, but we're at least being intentional. And so for the next few minutes, I want to talk about the different stages of parenting our kids when it comes to dating, the different stages. When your kids are young, like my kids are, toddlers, preschool, early elementary school, these years are all about setting the bar and setting the standard for our kids. We are providing them with an example that they can look to and that they can follow in the future. And I want to speak specifically to the dads here. Dads, if you have boys, young boys at home, during these early years, you are showing your son what a healthy romantic relationship looks like by the way that you treat their mom, by the way that you treat your wife, by the way you serve her and speak to her and value her and show affection to her. You are showing and demonstrating to your sons who pick up on a lot on the way to treat a woman in a way that honors the Lord and values her. And if you have young girls at home, You are setting the standard for them by the way that you love on them and care for them. And you need to be showing them constant affection and affirmation and attention during those early years, because if they don't get that from you as their dad, they will be tempted to go look for that in someone else when they are older. You need to be setting the bar, the standard so high as a dad that when they come across some loser in high school, they're not going to settle for him, because they know the way that their dad has cared for them, the way that their dad has treated them. These early years are all about, here's the bar, here's the standard, here's the example to follow. But listen, by late elementary school, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, you need to start having conversations with your kids about sex and about dating, because their friends at school are already talking about these things. The kids on their sports team are already talking to them about this kind of stuff. And your job as a parent is to try and stay ahead of it, to try to stay in front of it. Obviously, you want to make these conversations age appropriate, but you need to be having these conversations early and often, likely before you're ready to have them, likely before you feel like you need to be saying anything. You should be talking about, even when they're in third or fourth grade, hey, here's what dating is going to look like in our family in the future. Hey, here are the kind of things that you should be looking for when you start to think about dating. Here's what mom and dad's involvement is going to be in the process. But if your plan as a parent is, you know what, I'm just going to wait till they're 13, or I'm just going to wait till they're in high school to talk about it, man, you've already fallen behind. Because they have already learned about these things and are looking to something else to guide them and to instruct them in this. We got to have conversations early and often. All right, let's talk about the middle school and high school years. These are probably the most challenging years, but when it comes to dating, these are probably the most important and the most crucial. I want to give you a few things here. The first is that your approach has to adapt as they mature, meaning that the way you parent them in this topic needs to match their level of maturity and responsibility. And so you don't parent your 12-year-old like they're 18, where you give them unlimited freedom and unlimited access and provide no supervision. But then you don't treat your 18-year-old and parent them like they're 12, where you're overly controlling and you're trying to micromanage every part of their life. No, your approach has to adapt, has to change as they mature. Like when they're in middle school, they need clear rules and boundaries to follow. You can't just give your kids principles and concepts and expect them at 13 to take those principles and then apply them to the different situations in their life. No, they need boundaries and rules that are consistently enforced by their parents. But as they get older, as they get to high school, freedom is earned through responsibility. And you have to start to loosen the reins and loosen the restrictions as they earn your trust. And then if they break your trust, then for a season, you tighten the reins. The restrictions are enforced more. But your approach has to change as they mature. If you think what you're doing with your 12-year-old is what you're going to do with your senior in high school, man, it's going to lead to a lot of frustration on both parts. Secondly, and this is something I learned during my years in student ministry, use their friends as coaching opportunities. And here's what I mean by that. Your teenagers are not going to volunteer very much about themselves. You can ask them 100 questions and you'll get 100 one-word answers. Like they're not just going to volunteer this information. But one of the things I've learned about teenagers is they love to talk about people at their school. And they will throw their friends under the bus. And so as they're bringing up their friends and decisions they're making, and hey, did you hear this person's dating this person and they're talking to this person, use it as an example to parent and to coach them. Turn it around on them. Ask, hey, like, what do you think about that? How would you approach that? What kind of advice would you give to your friend. You're doing a Jedi mind trick on them. They don't even realize you're parenting or coaching them in the process. And if they're in the room and they're hearing this, they'll forget about it in like 10 minutes. So you'll be good. And then third, and I think this is the most important one, and I think all parents need to hear this for every area of parenting, but especially dating. Resist the pressure to conform. Amen. Amen, brother. There is so much pressure as a parent to conform to what you see other parents and other families doing. Like they got their kid a phone and are letting them have social media, and you know they're letting you know their kid go to that party without supervision, and they're letting their kid go on dates in middle school, and you don't want to be the weird parent. You don't want to be the parent that's always having to tell your kids no. You want your kids to be normal. You want them to be included and liked. You don't want them to feel left out. But let me remind you today that you are the parent, which means that you are in charge. And just because every other parent and every other family does something does not mean that you have to. And just because something is normal does not mean it's good or that it's right. You need to do what is best for your kids and your family, even if it makes you the weird family. Even if it means maybe your kids might get left out from the party. You don't have to do what everyone else is doing. You're allowed to be different. Do not conform to the patterns of this world. Resist the pressure of, man, we just have to do it because everybody else is. And then finally, the college years. You know, at this point, they are, or at least they should be, making most of their own decisions. And you've moved more into the mentor or coach role as a parent. But the hope is that you have parented in such a way through elementary school and through middle school and through high school that now when they're in their 20s and they don't live under your roof and you can't control them, that they still want to come back to you because they value the relationship and they value your advice. Like parents of young kids, that's the goal. You want to parent in such a way that when your kid is 25, they still come back to you and value your wisdom and value your insight. Listen, every 18-year-old thinks their mom and dad is completely out of touch. Like they just do. But when they turn 25, all of a sudden, mom and dad get really smart. Mom and dad all of a sudden have a lot of wisdom. And so my encouragement to you, if you're in those years of parenting where you've kind of loosened the reins, they're out doing their own thing, stay engaged. Keep leaning in. Keep being involved. They need you during these years, even though the dynamic has changed, because they're starting to make real adult decisions. They're thinking about proposing. They're thinking about moving. They're thinking about taking that job, and they need your wisdom and your guidance along the way. Parents, there is simply too much at stake for you to just punt on your responsibility in this area of your kid's life. Because outside of your kids trusting to follow Jesus, who they choose to marry, that is the most important decision that they're going to make in their life. It's going to set the direction, the trajectory of their life. And their spouse is either going to be a blessing to them as they seek to follow Jesus and live on mission for him and raise kids to know Jesus and follow Jesus, or their spouse will be a liability when it comes to their faith and will cause them to become apathetic or indifferent or to compromise in their convictions. And so parents, don't just sit on the sideline and let the world teach your kids about this. And don't be intimidated to step in when it feels awkward and uncomfortable and messy. No, lean in and engage. It's not your responsibility as their parent to pick their spouse for them. But it is your responsibility to teach, and to instruct, and to guide them, because dating is an opportunity for discipleship with your kids. And we want to teach our kids to pursue someone in a way that honors the Lord and leads to a healthy marriage that glorifies God in the process. And so I'd love to take a moment to pray for us before we wrap up this morning. So with our heads bowed, our eyes closed, God, we thank you for the truth of your word, how even in our modern day world that looks so different than biblical times, your truth is still relevant, it still applies. And so Lord, I pray for those in this room who are thinking about marriage and the future, who are trying to figure out what dating looks like, God, that you would give them wisdom and discernment, that they would pursue someone for the right reasons, God, that they would not settle in terms of the person's faith or integrity or their character. God, that you would surround them with wise counsel to speak into their life, that you would give them the humility to hear that, to receive that. And Lord, that they would not look for their fulfillment and their satisfaction in life in a person or a relationship or a marriage, but realize, God, that it can only be found in you. You are the only one who can meet the deepest longings and desires of their heart. It's only through a relationship with Jesus, God, are we truly satisfied. And Lord, I also pray for the parents in this room, for the grandparents in this room. There are those like me who are just beginning our journey as parenting. There are those who have seen their kids get married or are enjoying the blessing of grandchildren. God, I pray that you would just help us today to feel the weight of the responsibility as parents, of engaging in this part of our kids' life, of providing an example to follow, and wisdom and guidance and teaching along the way. God, when it feels awkward and uncomfortable for us, Lord, that we would not turn away, but Lord, that we would lean into that, that we would take our role seriously as parents. God, that we wouldn't feel this pressure to conform or to just give in to what we see everyone else doing. But God, that we would raise children, Lord, who love you, who serve you, and who honor you in all parts of their life. So Father, we love you, we praise you, and we ask all of this in the name of your Son, Jesus.